and welcome to Hidden Behind the Music Stand. I'm your host, Patty Ryan, and with me is Michael Majorana, who is a composer based in the Twin Cities and has had his works performed by ensembles Lumina, New Year, Zeitgeist, 10th Wave Chamber Music Collective, the Princeton Singers, and Play. He's also participated in Minneapolis St. Paul composition workshops, including Vocal Essence Remix, Magpies and Ravens Lineage, and the Nautilus Composer Librettist Studio, along with attending the Lehigh University Choral Composition Forum, the University of Missouri Kansas City Composition Workshop, and the European American Musical Alliance Summer Music Institute. And we'll be talking about his connection in nature, visiting state and national parks. Welcome, Michael. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so of course, 10th Wave Chamber Music Collective, that's how we kind of met. I've played your compositions through that ensemble, and one of my favorite projects over lockdown was doing this virtual concert together that was intended to be a live performance that is only possible virtually, or I should say only possible, but part of it was this virtual interconnectedness and lagginess in internet performance.
Yeah, yeah. All the music was written to take all of that into account. So it wasn't just trying to like, oh, let's just put a piece, like a regular kind of old composition that I've done, into a Zoom space, into like the interconnected laggy internet space, but like writing a whole new set of music that fits all of that. So it's kind of the, I don't know if you want to go into the detail about like how all that works or explain it, or if you'd like me to.
Either way, I was just going to say though that it's so different than how we're classically trained. We're so classically trained to be on the beat, on time, and, you know, maybe little dark or bright side of the beat, but not anything that's not supposed to be ensemble-y together, in air quotes. But yeah, I mean, yeah, so maybe you can describe a little bit of that kind of project.
Yeah, so like you were saying, it invites like a lot of improvisation into it. It demands improvisation because nothing can line up. So it's like over the pandemic, everyone singing happy birthday together on Zoom. Like you can't, it doesn't go together.
Right.
Just all kind of laggy, hap, hap, hippie burp, and like everything's all jumbled up. So yeah, it's terrible. So to do something that is pleasant, I had to, yeah, write a whole new set of music. So for that project with 10th Wave, I was intending to write 20 minutes of music, but wrote about 45 minutes of music for everyone to play together. And it was all, yeah, taking all that into account. So how can we write something that has rhythm and melody and harmony and all of that, but like nothing can actually line up on a beat all together? We weren't using a click track or anything. It was all no conductor either. It was just all by ear. So everything that all the musicians were hearing was what the audience was hearing too, which I thought was really cool, bringing the audience into like the actual exact moment of music making. There wasn't any audio processing, no reverb was added. It's just like you're all on a Zoom call together. Yeah. So the audience is kind of on a Zoom call with the musicians, which I really enjoyed that aesthetic.
Well, yeah. And I thought it was a great way of embracing kind of the disconnectivity that we've had or felt during lockdown and us trying to reach out. I haven't discovered or known of a composer that has tried to actually utilize that world. And I felt it was just a really cool project and so many cool pieces that you created. So thanks for including me in your mindscape world composition of that.
Yeah, thanks so much for being a part of it. And I was heavily influenced by C4 is a choral ensemble in New York and now spread out across. They've done collaborations with groups in LA and Austin quite frequently, but they started in March and April 2020 doing these live remote concerts. Mm-hmm. So they would put on concerts and they used Zoom for the video and Jamulus for the audio. And with 10th Wave, we use Zoom for the video and CleanFeed for the audio. Zoom's great for a lot of things, but it intentionally suppresses everything but the top two or three voices. So if you try to have eight people performing at the same time, it'll just bring out one or two or three random ones here and there and just suppress all the others. But CleanFeed just gives you that direct audio signal. It doesn't do barely any audio processing. So it lets all those voices come through all together. But yeah, C4 and Karen Siegel in particular was writing a lot of live remote pieces. And she has a whole repertoire of live remote choral pieces on her website, which I recommend everyone go check out if you're interested in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Very niche. It's like a niche of a niche to be doing this live remote performance inside classical music.
But
super
it's
interesting.
Trying to find the silver lining of a situation, I'd say. Yeah.
Yeah. And what I really liked about it, so a lot of people were doing these virtual productions of chord all your parts separately, and then somebody spends 50 hours stitching it all together in a video later, which is great. It's great to make music like that. And people got excellent products. But as like a performing musician, it didn't have
detracts.
That ensemble energy
totally
there. And not in a sense of performance or anything, but in a sense of just like friendly psychology. It's just like you're not as connected with the musicians. You can look at yourself in the final product, but you're not having that ensemble experience where you're all together, all doing the same thing together. And just like the talking in between like little bits or like talking as you're getting set up or tearing down. So I really like that part of doing the live remote experience with 10th Wave.
Yeah, that was a really special project. Can you tell me your most insane performance story, or I guess most surreal one?
Yeah, the story I was thinking of. So back in college at Grinnell College, for a couple of years there, I organized a 24-hour composition thing. So people do these kinds of things all the time. Just get a bunch of performers, bunch of composers, and meet up. So we met up on a Friday night and connect everyone up all together, assign performers to composers, just whoever happens to show up after I sent out an email to everyone I know. And so the third year I did it, I think I was kind of excited to do something a little different. So I paired up myself with two other composers. So three of us were all working on a piece together, and we decided to set the text from the children's book, I Want My Hat Back by John Klassen. I don't know if you know that book.
I don't.
It's pretty funny. So it's just like a bear's looking for his hat and asks all the animals in town if he's seen his hat. And one of the animals is a rabbit and is wearing the hat. And the rabbit says, I haven't seen your hat. Don't ask me any more questions. And then it just keeps going, asking all the animals. And at the end, he asks maybe a snake or something. And the snake says, oh, describe your hat. And the bear says, oh, it's red and pointy. And then realizes that's the hat the rabbit was wearing. So like goes through the whole book, finally realizes it, and then finds the rabbit. And there's a page of, I don't remember, scribbles or something, or just angry colors. And then the bear is wearing the red hat, and somebody comes and asks the bear, oh, have you seen a rabbit wearing a hat around here? And the bear says, no, don't ask me any more questions. And that's the book. So it's just kind of bizarre children's book, setting that to music, going throughout the night. So just a 24-hour composition thing starts at 8 p.m. and you have 12 hours to write it. So 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. writing a piece with three people, setting this children's book. And then it's performed the following night. So they just have the daytime to practice it and perform it that night. And a weird thing that year is that we also incorporated dancers and choreographers. So it was just this whole kind of like weird mess, setting a children's book in 12 hours with two other composers to music for a drum set, a violinist, and a singer. And it's just like a weird experience. Just, why are we doing this? And and why are we making people listen to this and watch this? But it was great. It was a fun time.
Okay. Yeah. Was it a success?
I'd say so. Yeah, I still think about it. It was a good time.
Yeah. Okay. Are you ready for some spitfire questions?
Sure.
Mahler or Bruckner?
Ooh, Mahler.
Debussy or Ravel?
Ooh, that's a good question. I really love them both, but I gotta say Ravel.
Okay. Cats or dogs?
Dogs. Allergic to cats.
Aw. So. Appetizers or desserts?
Appetizers.
Sparkling or still water?
Still water for sure.
Okay.
Too prickly.
Oh, okay.
If it's sparkling.
Fan favorite question, alternate universe musical instruments?
So I grew up playing viola, and now I do some piano and sing in a choir and play some electric bass. So other than that, cello is a great one. I mean, I feel like a lot of people just say cello, but flute also kind of draws my attention.
Okay.
So maybe flute.
All right. Early bird or night owl?
Night owl.
Pandemic guilty pleasure?
I've been buying a lot of Alden's ice cream. I don't know if you've had Alden's before. I think it's an Oregon brand, but it's super creamy. So just getting the vanilla and then eating it out of the bucket. It's just like very good. Very good ice cream.
I mean, I recommend it. Yeah. Like, I don't blame you. Ice cream is definitely a comfort food. Favorite professor shout out?
When I studied at Grinnell, I studied a lot with John Romerheim. Took a lot of classes with him. He was the choral director and taught composition classes as well. So yeah, I worked with him a bunch, and that was kind of really formative at the beginning of my formal composition training. So John Romerheim, excellent composer, conductor, teacher.
Thanks. Most inspired musical hero of any genre?
I grew up listening to a lot of Jethro Tull.
Oh.
So Ian Anderson, frontman, songwriter, Jethro Tull. So part of the flute answers maybe from that, just like the way he works with the flute in that non-classical context. So it's a lot of like jazz flute influences, but he just does some really cool things with that. And especially his album, Thick as a Brick, is 42 minutes long and just like a masterpiece, I think. It's so good. And maybe it's just listening to it a bunch in, I don't know, middle school and high school, but that left a big impression on me. So yeah, Ian Anderson.
Most transformative performance experience?
Maybe it would be the live remote performances over the pandemic. Transformative in like a lot of ways. Transformative in that I was putting on like whole concerts of my music, doing all the scheduling and logistics and budget. So 10th Wave took over some of the scheduling and logistics. But the previous year, August 2020, I put on a concert with Aliro Voices, a choir in town that I sing with that Kurt Hattenberger conducts. And that was my first trial of doing all that live remote stuff, figuring out all the tech stuff, writing music that works in that amorphous, improvisatory, jumbled up space. So that was transformative for me, just to like take control of like all the aspects of putting together the concert, doing the promotion stuff. And Aliro Voices helped with that, and Kurt helped with that, and Ian Cook helped with the graphic. But yeah, just putting that all together and navigating a whole new kind of genre, a whole new medium. That was pretty transformative for me, I'd say.
Okay. Desert island piece of any genre?
I'm really partial to Ravel's string quartet.
Ooh.
But maybe, I don't know if I could listen to that forever. Maybe I could. There's a really good Arvo Pärt piece, My Heart's in the Highlands, that just gets me every time I listen to it. It's just for organ and solo voice.
Wow.
There's an excellent, excellent performance of it on YouTube. I think the singer is Elsa Torp, if I'm saying that right, and if I'm remembering right. But yeah, really interesting piece, meditative. So I guess it depends on what I'm looking for on the desert island, if
sure.
I'm looking to wallow or take my mind off being trapped on a desert island, if it's a bad desert island to be trapped on. I don't know. But yeah, so probably that Arvo Pärt, My Heart's in the Highlands.
So Oregon is definitely on your island.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just to wallow, maybe, in that Oregon sound.
Right. Okay, well, you've completed the Spitfire questions. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I forgot that when you inhale, that doesn't resolve it.
Just leave us hanging.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Michael, can you walk me through your musical origin story? How did you become a composer, instrumentalist, and take me through the steps of your studies to where you are today?
Sure. Growing up, we listened to a lot of music all the time. Just my dad was really into classic rock, so the Jethro Tull came from there. And we had a couple classical CDs. We had a Bach double violin concerto that was really just like sticks in my head still. That specific recording was excellent, and I don't remember the performers. And I've tried to track it down. I can't find it. But yeah, so a couple classical CDs in there, mostly classic rock, and just dancing around to those things. My mom played some piano, so she would play this one piece, and we would just run around the house, and she would speed up or slow down the tempo, and we'd have to like move slower or faster with that. So those are some earlier musical memories. And then I picked up the viola in fourth grade. So everyone tried out all the instruments in front of all the kids in the library. And we got to like choose which one we were most interested in. And my older brother played viola already. And my older sister played cello already. So it's just like those instruments are in the house. I could just use those.
I see.
And I was thinking about the violin, but it just sounded too like high and scratchy. Yeah. I don't know if it was the whoever was performing that for us or just like, yeah, too high. So I ended up choosing the viola and played that through middle school and high school. Then in middle school, so I grew up playing a lot of video games and listening to a lot of video game music. So an earlier kind of memory of music is trying to pick out the Ocarina songs from Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, or Ocarina, however people say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, just picking out those melodies that you learn in that game on the Ocarina and playing those. So then in middle school, I was getting more into actually like listening to a lot of video game music outside of the game, actually just listening to MIDIs or remixes of the game. So there's this website called OC Remix that has been around for probably 15 or 20 years now. At least 20. And it's a whole community of people who just take video game music and remix it and put it up there. And I'm not sure how it's like, how it still exists, how it's still legal and things like that. Uh-huh. Yeah. So listening to a lot of those, getting into listening to video game music and wanting to have sheet music for that. But there's not just sheet music for that floating around all the time.
Sure.
But there are a ton of MIDIs that people have put together. And I wanted to take those and look at the notation. So I downloaded this program, Anvil Studio, which was just a free notation program. And you could only look at one line at a time. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty limited. But yeah, so downloading MIDIs, putting those into Anvil Studio, and then looking at the notation, playing video game music from that notation was my intro to composition.
Okay.
So I had this notation program and was learning how it all worked, looking at these MIDIs from video game soundtracks, and just started putting in my own notes, seeing how they like fit together, trying things out. And that was probably seventh or eighth grade. So that's how I started composing, just having that notation software, hearing things that I put into it, getting more and more complicated, starting to like improvise in high school on the instruments that I had around, and then trying to notate those improvisations. And do in high school. Yeah.
Sorry, do you have perfect pitch by any chance?
No. No, okay. Not at all.
Relative at this point then. Mm-hmm. When you said you're picking out notes, I was curious if it was literally picking out notes or if it was scrambling to find it.
No, and that was the nice thing about having software that could play back the music. So it wasn't just like, I'll try this note, that sounds bad. I'll try this note, that sounds bad. It was kind of a mixture of having the playback and then seeing like, oh yeah, that's how it all fits together. And then just thinking like, oh yeah, this is like a little bit down. At that time, I wouldn't know names of intervals even. Yeah. But like, oh yeah, a little bit down, a little bit up. Like I'd hear something and then have to figure it out.
Okay.
Assisted by the computer playback.
Sure. Proceed.
Yeah. Participated in more ensembles, got more exposure to different instruments in high school. I played in the marching band Pit. It was a really good marching band, I think. We won state some number of years, the state championships. Excellent program. Still an excellent program. It was headed by Roger Smith at the time and then took over by Elon Jameson, and he still runs it and still does a fantastic job. But got to play marimba, xylophone, vibraphone, timpani, chimes, auxiliary percussion, just all those. So learning those instruments was kind of opening a new gateway, getting out of just viola, which I was never good at, never took lessons at, never practiced very well. So just like trying out new things invigorated a love of instruments at that time, I think. Uh-huh. And singing choirs, singing the chorus in theater productions. And then, yeah, moving to college, did more formal training in composition finally.
So you went to school to become a composer as a composition major, is that right?
I knew in the back of my mind that I was kind of interested in it, but I didn't apply to any conservatories. I wasn't really on any path like that. I looked more at my older sister had gone to Kalamazoo College, which is a smaller liberal arts school, and enjoyed it. And just talking to her about it, it seemed like like something I'd enjoy too. And my older brother went to College of the Atlantic in Maine, which is a really small school with a narrower focus. So I was interested more in the, liberal arts college. So I applied to a bunch of those and ended up going to Grinnell College in Iowa, just like middle of nowhere, an hour away from Des Moines, an hour away from Iowa City, just surrounded by cornfields, and really enjoyed visiting out there in the dead of winter when it was all frozen over and super windy. So if I enjoyed it then, I thought I'd enjoy it anytime. Yeah. So I ended up going there and studying composition kind of as a side thing for a bit. I was thinking I'd do something more like biology or some science, but ended up knowing that I wanted to do music and not really knowing anything else in particular. So it's just like, I'll do music. I know that's something I do like. So just ended up keeping going with music and did a bunch of, again, like opening up new doors to new instruments. I was able to participate in the early music ensemble and play on some of those period instruments, and participated in the gamelan for a few semesters, Javanese gamelan. And they had an ambira ensemble, so I got to play ambira for a bit, and then just singing in a couple of choirs there. Yeah, that was a great place to be because I didn't know that I wanted to do music specifically, and it was just a place that I could take a bunch of classes and a bunch of different things. But as it went on, they had no general requirements really, just like you had to take a couple of classes outside your major, outside your department or whatever, but it was pretty free. So I got to spend a lot of my time in my third and fourth year there just taking a lot of higher level music classes.
I see.
And I was also able to study abroad in Milan and study with Roberto Andreoni over there. That was a great experience. That was really cool.
Yeah, I'm jealous.
Yeah, that was fun.
So then after you graduated, did you go immediately to the Twin Cities, or how did you get connected to this area?
Yeah, I stuck around in Grinnell for a little bit and worked for the college, participated in an artist residency in town there. There's some people with a farm outside of town that just converted it into an artist residency, which was really cool to be a part of, and exploring some new musical ideas out there. And then, I ended up moving to the Twin Cities in 2014. My partner Mandy is from here and was interested in moving back here. I'm from Detroit, so just looking at the different musical opportunities in those places, it seemed like Minneapolis had a lot of things going on. I was already kind of familiar with some of the different organizations in town. I'd heard of Vocal Essence, I'd heard of Zeitgeist, and I had been listening to a podcast by Charlie McCarron, who's a local composer and board game maker and puts on events, and he just does all kinds of things. And for 5 or 6 years there, he was doing a podcast interviewing songwriters and composers, musicians. So he lives here in the Twin Cities. He would have people on in the area, so I was becoming familiar with the area already before moving here. And he also put on these composer quests to invite people to write music for specific ensembles in town here. And eventually he put on the Film Score Fest. So the end of the story is just that I was able to participate in it, and it was a fun time and encouraged me to move here. But to describe what it is, they pair up filmmakers and composers randomly, or you can request your own person you want to work with, but mostly randomly, and pair up filmmakers and composers to put together a 5-minute short film with a score. And the cool thing is that the score is performed live by an orchestra at the event. And what we've been doing in more recent years is having a click track to get it synced up well. So yeah, I was able to participate in that, had a really good time, and just knew like, Minneapolis has a ton of things going on. I should move here. So ended up moving here. And the cool thing is I was able to connect with a lot of those organizations that I was familiar with. So sang with Vocal Essence for a bit and had some of my music performed by them through that mentorship you mentioned, and had something performed by Zeitgeist through one of their mentorship opportunities. And I have worked with Charlie a lot on a lot of things and just hang out with him all the time now. So that's great. It's just like fun to be connected to all those music things in Minneapolis that I was familiar with before moving here. And just now it's a part of daily life, which is neat.
Totally. Can I ask you what it's like to have a career as a composer?
Yeah, it's so I moved here in 2014 and worked for the Minnesota Orchestra for a while in their ticket office. So this is just kind of to say that I've been doing freelance stuff since 2018, but before that doing more part-time work with different organizations. So I taught in the St. Paul Public Schools instrumental music after school and worked at the Minnesota Orchestra in various positions in their ticket office in front of house and things like that. So a lot of it for that period of time was just like squeezing it in wherever it fit in the background. And then since 2018, I've been doing more freelance stuff, received a couple grants that have pushed me along, buoyed me along along the way to do some of the more exciting projects. So received grants from the State Arts Board, the Minnesota State Arts Board, twice now, and ACF Create. It used to be the Jerome Fund for New Music, but the ACF Create grant from American Composers Forum, another organization in town that I was familiar with, just like that's a good reason to be in Minneapolis. Its headquarters is there, like the National Organization for Composers. So yeah, the project with Alliro Voices was supported through that ACF Create grant, and the project with 10th Wave, the Live Remote Project in June 2020, 2021. It was supported through one of the State Arts Board grants. So part of it is, yeah, pursuing grants and things like that, selling sheet music a little bit, just pursuing connections with people and performances, emailing a lot of people, networking. Along those lines, one of the things that's kind of like helped me in various ways of just like connecting with people and feeling connected and just kind of supported in the community is I've been running a kind of like a salon thing where I host people meeting up once a month to just look at each other's scores and give feedback, which has been really great just to feel connected to people, talk about these kinds of ideas of like, how do we exist as composers if people are in the stage where they're trying to do that full time or squeeze it in between other jobs? Like, how do we navigate all of that stuff? And especially during COVID, it's been really useful just to have a support network in that way. Composition slowed down for a lot of people for a lot of reasons in the pandemic. One of them just being that there haven't been as many performances around. So like the onus of a deadline to push you forward to finish a piece hasn't been there. But also the lack of inspiration, I think, has been a big thing for a lot of people, not having the stimulus from going to as many performances or like talking to as many people as regularly.
Totally. Yeah.
So most of the composers I know have slowed down a lot in the pandemic in terms of producing new stuff. So that was nice just to commiserate about that and be like, oh yeah, this is, everyone is going through this.
Yeah. Is a deadline important?
For sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Most of the stuff I write these days is for something. So like part of it is just like motivation and having a reason to like do something, not have to wait for inspiration or anything. So like a structure should set you up for that. Like a daily structure, like I'll compose for this many hours a day and I'll do it at this time. That should work, but doesn't always work. So it's nice to have something external saying like, you do need this by this day or people will be angry at you and sad. Yeah. So deadlines are super important. And part of that is having an ensemble to write for, knowing the instrumentation and everything.
Yeah.
Having a specific performance and specific performance space, specific performers. Yeah.
I was going to ask a similar question. How much does that play into how you compose? Like knowing the musicians personally, knowing the space, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. It's been really nice to write pieces for Aliro Voices, for instance, just because I sing with them. So I know everyone who's singing in there. I know their strengths and like ranges and everything and know what I can kind of write to. So when I was writing that live remote performance piece, it helped knowing like, oh yeah, these people can be the soloists in these sections. Potentially we have like these kinds of timbres in here and this is how everything will mix together. And for 10th Wave, it was less writing for like individual instruments and more like, oh yeah, Patty will be on cello, Ashley will be on violin, Whaley will be on clarinet. So it's just less the instrument, more like the person. And having heard all of you perform before, like knowing what you like to do and things like that really helps. I really relish that and have missed that in the pandemic, having fewer of those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Is there a common misconception of being a composer that you would like to squash?
That's a good question. I think the biggest misconception would just be that they're all dead, that there aren't any composers alive.
Sure.
Yeah, if somebody wasn't familiar with just like how many working composers there are, the way that a lot of people interact with that is through video games or film. All of that is just written by a person who exists and that you can meet and talk to. And that there's tons of new concert music, and it's not just somebody like writing for symphony orchestras like alone in a dark room. It's just like people who are around that you talk to are writing all the time for all kinds of things. So yeah, that they're all old and dead and that they're just writing for giant orchestras. Like, no. There are all kinds of people writing for all kinds of things.
I also wonder about the difference between film and video game composers versus concert composers. I feel like people like Hans Zimmer, John Williams, these huge Hollywood film composers are all put on these pedestals, but then there's so many living composers that are not as seen. And I know that that's, of course, because of the films that are attached to these composers, but is there anything that you can address between this separation?
Yeah, I think there's probably kind of two things. So part of it is just like when you're doing classical music or like what is put into the box of classical music, you're just kind of accepting like, oh yeah, this is a niche and like it'll be in its concert halls and in its performances in churches and all those kinds of things. And it won't reach massive audiences in the way that some giant multimedia production will. So there is that like separation in that way. But also I think it's a bit false to exclude the film composers and video game composers from like art music or like higher level music. I think that is something that sometimes is looked down on as like, oh, commercial music, like it's not art
sure.
anymore once you're doing it for more money and for more like popularity and reaching a bigger audience. So I think that is one of the false things in regards to commercial music, that it can be. I mean, like a lot of the torch of romantic music is carried by film composers more than some concert composers. So like some strains of classical music history are carried more by the film composers and they use really intense techniques. A lot of them are like very highly trained in various ways or just have tons of experience, hands-on experience doing music stuff. But one or the other, they're like top of their craft, top of the game. And I think any classical composer could learn a lot studying those scores. And then going deeper from that, like a lot of those scores that you're studying by Alan Silvestri or John Williams or any of them, you could learn also by going back to Holst or like John Williams, for instance, was taking stuff from like Korngold. And yeah, so it's just like, it is the strain of art music. It carried forward, but just kind of put into that multimedia context, which I think echoes things like opera. It's like a tradition carrying on that tradition of multimedia, just it's a new form. So I don't think it should be separated so much from art music as much as people want to separate those two.
Sure. So I want to tackle the issue of the dead composers versus the living composers and how I think it's the fault of a lot of programming decisions, but a lot of audiences want to hear the dead composers. They want to hear Beethoven. They want to hear Brahms. They want to hear Mahler, Bruckner, or Debussy, or Ravel, et cetera, et cetera. And as great as they are, it's hard to convince audiences to widen their view on what is being currently written and processed in a life that is happening now versus lives that were happening in the 1700s and the 1800s and the 1900s. Do you have any thoughts or experiences to tackle this?
Yeah. So my kind of thoughts on that, and having worked at the Minnesota Orchestra and just being around all the people who are buying the tickets and the donation sides of things, I think that's why a lot of people I know, a lot of the working composers I know, and just people who are writing music don't write for orchestra because it will never be performed. Mm-hmm. Because the orchestra, and things are changing now in a good way. Some orchestras are doing a particularly good job striving towards moving away from just Mozart and Beethoven. But the reason that they loom so large, Mozart and Beethoven in particular, and anything up until about like 1900, or maybe you can go into like 1920 if you squeeze some Stravinsky in there.
Right.
Maybe 1950 if you get some Aaron Copland. But it's the people who are putting money into those orchestras, either by buying tickets or by donating. They want to hear what they're familiar with, and they want those older pieces. They don't want to have those new experiences. So when the Minnesota Orchestra puts on its Future Classics concert, which is really cool music, but the pieces haven't been tested throughout hundreds of years. These aren't all going to be like masterpieces. Like, it's more of a risk to program a newer piece. So I understand that perspective from a large orchestra that needs to hit a certain quota for ticket sales and things like that. They don't want to take a risk on these new pieces that haven't been tested with audiences over 100 plus years. So I understand that perspective. But yeah, so the Future Classics concert might have, out of like 7 pieces, 2 or 3 that are really excellent and that you really want to hear over and over. But you have to put those pieces out there so that you can get that next generation of things that can survive on down the line and just introduce more of that newness and contemporariness, just like connection with life today. So people writing pieces about racial justice or climate change or just new sounds, just like working with sounds in a new way abstractly. Like, we've learned a lot and like tried a lot of things with the orchestra in the last 100 years that people should be hearing. But the competing needs of the orchestra to present new and exciting music, but also break even at the end of the day and still exist as a solvent organization is a tough nut to crack, I think. And people are trying to figure that out. Like, how do we get people to pay for these very expensive performances where you have 70, 80, 90 people on stage and then all the administrative staff that makes everything happen? How do you make that all work? So I guess the end of that is, for me, I don't plan to ever really write orchestral music for the concert stage.
Right.
I'll be writing more chamber music, more solo music, like duos, things with 10th wave, with choirs, because those are the organizations that can afford to do these newer pieces. Mm-hmm. They're not as trapped by how large and expensive it is to have the ensemble exist, which orchestras are hamstrung by that, I think, in taking new risks and trying new things. So like I said, some orchestras are doing a particularly good job with that, but it is a bigger risk for them to gamble on something and have the hall not fill up and have donors not be excited about it for the people who are paying $100 for a ticket or something like that. Mm-hmm. If they don't show up, then yeah, you'll just be losing money on that. And how many performances can you do where you lose money? And that ties in also to state support and things like that. How willing is the federal or state government to support those organizations? So if we had more support like that, they could take more risks. They wouldn't have to rely as much on donations and things like that. But I don't know what the solutions are. But for me, practically as a composer, it just means, I don't write for orchestra because they'll never perform it. And it's too much work for something that will never be performed. But chamber music is great.
Well, I mean, I'm biased with that too. And also, like, I didn't mean to completely direct or criticize the orchestra and programming and things like this. And I know that you don't either.
No, yeah, and we can, so
it's definitely a more complicated topic. Well, and that I just think about music history, and I think about how there was once a time when Mozart string quartets or symphonies were, that was the new music of the day. And now, I don't know if it's because of recordings, even up into the 20th century, where where, you know, Stravinsky also was the bop of the day, or, you know, and Fantasia, which was, you know, just bringing in Disney, for instance, like Disney's yeah. Fantasia, a lot of the music that's in the original is pieces that were written within the 20 years or something. It's weird to think about that now we don't see our current composers in that similar light, or we don't give them the opportunity to be showcased in a particular light like that.
Or it takes like an auteur director to like select a specific piece, like Arvo Pärt's Fratres is in There Will Be Blood, mm-hmm. so like people can be exposed to it in that way.
Sure.
Or Johnny Greenwood's score for that is like really kind of crazy. And he's coming from Radiohead, so people are hearing the stuff that sure. he does anyway.
Right.
But yeah, like a director can pull a specific piece into their movie, but yeah, it doesn't happen super often.
Yeah, and I hope that there's more opportunities somehow, or people are more willing to open their perspective on what is, there's still way more room for a lot more imagination rather than always reverting back to a comfort zone of, which we all love, but it's still a comfort zone of tonality in some way, or yeah. a traditional version of tonality, maybe I should say.
Yeah, and part of it, again, with the chamber music thing is just like a kind of grassroots idea of what music can be. Mm-hmm. Working with the people around you to put things on for like smaller community concerts, just like the people who are nearby, who you know, coming to your concerts, or hopefully like grabbing a couple strangers to come into your concert one way or another. But that kind of like grassroots effort is what I am interested in as a composer, and like interested in writing for more of those. So part of that is writing for more amateur performers, like not being as worried about working with the highest caliber things. It's a treat when I get to work with ensembles like 10th Wave, but also being excited to work with like educational ensembles. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite pieces I wrote for a third grade choir, and they did an excellent job, like really cool stuff. But part of being a composer for me is not being so worried about working with the highest caliber musicians possible, but being mm-hmm. excited to work with anyone and treating it more as a community enterprise and being all right with that, which I am. It's great.
Yeah. Okay, Michael, is this a good time to take a break?
Sure.
Okay, we'll be right back. Welcome back from the break. So when I was performing your pieces in this Zoom clean feed environment, I was really struck by the selections and inspirations you drew from your pieces. One of which I mentioned on Jason Wells' episode of Old Survivor, which is about a redwood tree in which park again?
It's in Redwood Regional Park in the Oakland Hills.
Yeah, and also there's miniature pieces, and they were based on photos of sunrises or sunsets in Point Pelee Park.
That's
and
right, yeah.
You would even, you know, at first when I'm playing it just notationally, it was like, okay, this is like nice. But then when you gave us the photo, it really put all that vividness and color to perspective, and it really informed, oh, like this is what he means by asking for this. So obviously you value nature and the outdoors significantly, and that it's reflected in your music. Can you elaborate on that inspiration source?
Yeah, for the Live Remote project in particular, part of that was like we're all in our own homes doing our own little things, living in our own little worlds, and then connected over Zoom and CleanFeed, but we're not in any kind of physical space together. So writing music about some specific place felt like a way to put us all in a physical place together. So we're all in our own homes instead of like in a performance space together. Instead, we could be looking at this photo and all meditating on it and thinking about like, oh, we're all in this national park together. And that would connect everyone and connect the audience too, who's in their own totally different worlds as well. So just having that kind of centering place I thought was really important for those live remote performances. But for me specifically, part of wanting to choose those places is that they were connected with places that my family had vacationed to. So writing in February, March 2021, so like already a year into the pandemic at that point, really wanting that kind of connection to places that I couldn't go to, people that I couldn't see in person, and just meditating on those previous experiences going to those places with family. So that was important to me in that sense. And then the photos don't have people in them. It's separated from that concept. So in my mind, there's like people there, and any place that you go, I mean, people can travel independently, but places can be connected to people a lot of times. So yeah, that's all wrapped in there for me for that project. So the different places in that project, one of them was Point Pelee National Park in Canada, as you mentioned, and that juts out into Lake Erie. It's the southernmost tip of mainland Canada. So jutting out into Lake Erie, one of the Great Lakes, it just gets really interesting weather effects, and we'd always go there in the winter. So in the winter, it could be covered in snow, like many feet deep snow, just that had been blown out onto the shore there. or sheets of ice, like you'd see. I feel like when people go to Lake Superior in the winter on the North Shore of Minnesota, there's sheets of ice a lot of times that have been built up, or just like high winds jutting out into the lake like that. So going back many years in a row in the winter, or always around New Year's and trying to catch the sunset, just having like a different sense of the place, how the place can be different one year to the next, and using that as inspiration for the pieces, just like the amorphousness of that place. So it could be super icy one year. So the second movement of that piece was taken from an icier year with really interesting ice formations. And that has like a glassier quality. And I think I asked for like tinkly atmospheric percussion improvised for the percussion players on that piece. And the first movement was from a much greener and wetter year, less icy. And that just had a more kind of like jungly feel to it from the little woods that lead out onto the tip there.
So when you create compositions with nature in mind, are you really trying to capture the aural nature of the nature, or are you trying to bring to light more of the visual side?
It's kind of, yeah, both for sure. So like taking inspiration from a photo, just looking at the composition of it, seeing like how much sky there is, how much ground there is when the sun's there, like all the different colors that come into that. The photos for Point Pelee were a lot of like blues, and then with the sunset, oranges. Not that I have synesthesia or anything, but just thinking about like the way that those photos make me feel. So thinking about the place, thinking about the people, and then thinking about just like the color composition, texture composition of the photos, and kind of trying to put all of that into it and draw out different things from that. And a different approach was with the Old Survivor piece with Jason. I'm not sure how much you talked about it on the last episode with him, but the inspiration for that piece was less imagistic, less color, less texture, and more about the story of the tree in the forest, that it was just that one tree left over from two rounds of logging in the 1800s and early 1900s, the only old growth redwood in that area. So it's growing and like all those things going throughout the piece, just feelings of growth and greenery and plenty. And then having it just be a kind of programmatic piece of like, here's this period of time in this tree's life where everything's growing. Here's this period where everything gets cut down, and then the period where things are growing back, another period in the life where everything's cut down again, a period of growing back, and just kind of like reflecting on those things from the perspective of the tree. So that was a more programmatic linear time piece, but a lot of the others are more just imagistic, how it felt as a kid going to those places, how I feel now looking at those pictures and just drawing out inspiration from wherever I can on those. The other pieces on the 10th Wave Live Remote Concert were from Caseville, Port Austin State Park in the Tip of the Thumb in Michigan. So not as much nature, but just like spending time at those places, looking at the minnows flitting around in there. So the inspiration for the minnows piece was just like a school of fish moving around. It could be any school of fish, but that was the one from my childhood memory, just like watching those minnows flit around, trying to catch them in just like their glistening little slivers of sunlight in there, and trying to capture that in the piece, which had everyone kind of doing these aleatoric cells and moving together roughly within one or two cells of each other, like a school of fish just guiding itself in, like, I think in a bird formation it'd be called a murmuration. I don't know if you'd call it that with fish. But another piece on that set is just making drip castles. So some of those nature things can be more just like activities in those nature places, but the dunes are just like rolling hills that seemed endless as a kid. So like if I went there now, I would probably write a different piece inspired by those dunes. But as a kid, it just felt like an endless desert expanse, which it wasn't. Right. And I would definitely not think of it now. So a lot of it is how I saw those things as a kid and trying to put those into music now.
So is it safe to say that you are an environmentalist?
Yeah, I'd say so for sure.
Do you feel like when you compose pieces that are based in nature, do you have a hint of saying, hey, we need to preserve these places for future generations to see? I know this is a very leading question.
Well, yeah, so the Redwood piece, Old Survivor, is kind of points in that direction, I'd say, thinking about logging and like how there could just be grief of a single tree left in that area. So I mean, now it's like reforested and things, but just like that we can clear cut an entire region more or less, and like that just happens all the time. And then like in my own life, when I'm just walking around places, it always feels a little bit melancholy. There's excellent parks all around Minneapolis and St. Paul. There's one nearby to me now, Reservoir Woods over in St. Paul. And there's just this really beautiful patch of oak savanna in this residential neighborhood. And it's like, oh, this could all be like this. But no, it's just this little patch that we've preserved. And even that was all its newer growth. It's called Reservoir Woods because they put just a big reservoir of water to supply drinking water to the city up there. And then later kind of let it regrow into what it would have been before. So yeah, always like a kind of sense of melancholy for myself moving through those places. And I think that goes into a lot of my music about those things. So it's not always explicit, like, oh, this tree is cut down and now we're sad.
Right.
But it can just be like feelings of nature. And then those can be tied up with melancholy for me. And then put those feelings into the music of like, oh yeah, this is ephemeral and at our mercy as a species. We can choose to destroy or preserve these things as we see fit. And a lot of that's already been done. So it's the melancholy sense of that, like, oh, we can't get back a lot of those old growth things. For instance, we can let things regrow, but some things are lost forever. So putting that sense of melancholy into the music is definitely something I get out of nature, which is sad, but it's like a nice way to kind of filter those emotions and think about them.
I would also, again, imply or assume that, do you feel like part of your job being a composer is reflecting the times that you live in?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been interested in doing that a little bit more outside of these just kind of like vague melancholy feeling pieces. And I haven't done it so much, but I want to connect more. Future projects, I want to connect more to moving past ideas of just like, oh, this is pretty. Here's a pretty sound. Here's some pretty things. And I mean, that's great. Music should be that way. A lot of pieces, it's fine if it's just, this is a nice sound, or this is like a novel sound. This is a weird sound. It doesn't need to be connected to action or anything like that all the time, I think. But I am interested in getting more into that. So I've been talking about the same pieces over and over in this conversation, but the Aliro Voices Live Remote concert in August 2020 was more of a piece like that for me, more social justice connected for me, more of the time and of a previous time, because it was setting a speech by Harry Hopkins, who is director of the WPA, the Works Progress Administration under FDR. So 1930s, 1940s. And I set a speech for Aliro, and it was a speech given at a WPA luncheon in 1936, essentially just a defense of New Deal principles and saying like society has a responsibility to care for all its members, giving them jobs, giving them support. So it's an older idea, older text, older
context,
everything, but it felt very connected to the conversations that were happening at that time when I was writing it in 2020, just after the pandemic had kind of started. So like Congress was debating these relief packages and deciding like how much to support people who were on unemployment and in what ways to support them monetarily. So it felt very current in that way to say like, oh yeah, we need to be supporting everyone and we need to make sure we're like doing right by everyone in society from top to bottom.
Yeah.
So it felt very present in that way. So I was excited to work more with those kinds of ideas.
Yeah. Can you walk me through a compositional process that you like, let's say I were to say, go out in the woods, I'm going to pay you X amount of money to write me a cello solo or something like that, and write it about this random walk in the woods that you take. Can you describe what thought processes you go through to create a composition?
Yeah. So like we kind of talked about before, and like that prompt would have a lot of it in it, knowing like who you're writing for, what instrument you're writing for. And then if there's like a performance date and things like that, those are the professional technical aspects and getting that all lined up. And inspirational aspects, knowing it's cello is kind of a whole thing. So like knowing that I was writing for solo bass for Jason on Old Survivor, it let me think in terms of an individual, like an individual voice against what became like a solo bass with improvisatory kind of accompaniment from the rest of the ensemble. So that kind of led me towards like, oh yeah, the bass is this one tree. So that was that inspirational thread to follow. So writing for solo cello, it could be something similar to that. Like this is a singular entity somewhere that has its own point of view that it's speaking from. Another thing is just kind of picking up from my well, like my bucket of ideas that I have by the side to think about and like, oh, how does this fit into like a project I already am kind of thinking about doing? Is this something that I have in my list? So when you say solo cello, it makes me think of, I took a trip up to Jay Cook State Park back in May, and there's some huge river up there and there's an overlook over the river, and you can just hear the power of the river there and just kind of sit in it. It's so kind of loud and present. It's everything that's going on in your field of view. It's everything going on in your ears. You don't have to think about anything else. That can just like fill you all the way up. So while I was sitting there, I was thinking like, how would I transcribe the sounds of the river? How would I like translate that into music that it is like filling up your whole space, like that whole wall of sound? So thinking of solo cello, and I mean, you said the woods, but close enough to the river. Maybe I could convince you the opportunity to do that. But yeah, the river and getting some kind of either a recording of the river and like transcribing it rhythmically, which would be kind of fun, or trying to hear the different sounds. It's kind of like rapids at that point with the water going over rocks, and there's just like a lot of little eddies to look at, lots of little threads to get lost in, just in your field of view, looking at all these different little minute details. So yeah, trying to fit it into the bucket of ideas I have, or just sitting there and letting something come. And a lot of it's just through improvisation. I would get going on a piece, so like recording a lot of different improvisation on piano going into a DAW or something like Logic, or I have a loop pedal that I use a lot, a three-track loop pedal, Boss RC300. So I'll like record bass into that. So I wrote a lot of the bass piece on electric bass, and then part of talking with Jason was figuring out how to translate that well into upright bass. Yeah, so singing a lot of things I would do to get going on a piece. But yeah, spending a lot of time in the place if possible, or looking at photos like we were talking about, like trying to approach it from those different things, like how is it connected to me emotionally? Like who do I know, who I go to that place with? How do I feel when I sit there? What do I hear? What do I see? Or if it's just like a picture of the place, like what's the composition of that photo? Trying to draw from all those different places and then just see what happens next.
I guess I asked that question because I know that as many of us who relate with nature, we focus on certain parts, or maybe some people focus more on the journey, the hike itself, and their own personal spiritual awakening and doing such a thing. Or some people, like when you're describing how the water flows over these rocks, or the sound, the aural sound of the force of the river, et cetera, et cetera. It's just interesting to gain what you pick up. Do you ever find that it's a struggle to put what you observe into a notation or music in some way?
For sure. Yeah. I've been trying to get better and better about throwing things away when they don't work. And one thing for the 10th Wave Live Remote project was just like figuring out how to really capture the place. So like if I take things from my old buckets of ideas, that can sometimes be like melodic fragments and things. So I'll try to plug those into a new piece about a place. But if it's not the exact right character for that place, I can end up going down the wrong path for a long time. I usually throw away at least one draft before getting going on a piece, and usually more. Sometimes they can be pretty like fleshed out and then like, nope, this isn't quite the right direction for this one.
That sounds frustrating though.
Yeah. And part of being a composer, it feels like everything needs to be a masterpiece, or like this piece needs to be really good. So if you get one out of your system that like you really want it to be good, you try really hard and it doesn't work out, you throw that away and then you just like let yourself do whatever. You let it just flow out in the next one. So that can help a lot, just like getting all of your feelings of like needing to be good out in the first one that you're able to throw away. So that's what I like that a lot about composition, that I can do that alone in a room and not have anyone see like all the nervousness of like trying to get something right on the first try. I can get all that out in a bad first draft and then start a new one where I don't feel as pressured about that. So when I'm trying to write music about a specific kind of feeling I get from a specific place, or watching a piece of nature happen in front of me, like wind blowing through the trees or water flowing somewhere or a bug moving around, some motion that I can observe out in the world outside of myself, out in nature. One approach I like to take sometimes is just to capture a lot of those images with photos or videos and then do a bunch of little like looping things on the loop pedal I have with my electric bass. And then instead of trying to have specific inspirations from those places, just have a giant back catalog of like these photos and videos, and then a giant back catalog of these little looping things, and then try to pair them up and see which ones fit with each other and what they draw out of each other and how I can fit those together. So not always just taking inspiration from the place, but like knowing, ooh, this is a really cool image that I'm excited about. And it can just be like an ant carrying a little leaf across my field of vision in the camera, or wind blowing through like grass growing next to Lake of the Isles. Or I have a funny little video, a lot of wasps crawling in and out of this old dead fish.
Oh, no.
And then figuring out like what music do I have that like fits this weird process of life of like wasps crawling in and out of this carcass. So then part of it is just like I have these feelings in music, and I have these feelings in these videos I've taken, like which of these feelings match up. And sometimes it is just like the composition of the frame, like how much motion is there, how much stillness is there. So I've been doing that a lot actually. I take these 1 minute videos if I see something interesting, or like there are a bunch of turkeys around since the pandemic, or at least I've been noticing the turkeys a lot more. So yeah, take a video of some turkeys for a minute and then try to pair it up with something I've done in my back catalog of looping little things. And yeah, like which one fits that little turkey parade? What's a turkey parade piece of music?
Well, it's just funny because all the turkeys, at least the ones in Minnesota, they stop traffic. And so it is really like a parade going down when they cross the street.
Very notable, very eye-catching. So I've been putting those together for a while, actually, under the name Goodnight Morpheus. Just like a little side project of these like paired up videos. And those have been really fun. I got the idea from Ray Lustig, who I think teaches at Juilliard. And he had been doing that, just like the constraints were 15 second videos, just like whatever, they could be anything, but just like a 15 second video. And then you pair some music to it. And then I had seen my friend Ian Cook do some of those. And then I took that and have my own kind of rules where it has to be a 1 minute video. And I'm not allowed to like move the camera at all. It has to be like some motion within the frame. So like, yeah, the wind rustling something, or water falling, rain, waves on a shore, or like bugs moving around, or animals. So yeah, no people. I don't move the camera at all. 1 minute things, and then pairing up from my back catalog of things. I don't think I've ever written new music to those, but just kind of piecing together the puzzle of like, how does what I have already fit with any of these videos that I've taken? Mm-hmm. And that's been really fun.
When you started talking about being very regimented about specific films and not moving the camera, they're only going to be 15 seconds longer. Is that what you said, right?
I started maybe with 15 seconds long. And then I moved to the 1 minute, felt more like what I was trying to do. So yeah, I do those now.
I mean, that to me sounded very similar to what the 12 tone school ended up doing, was we have these constraints and we're going to create within those constraints, or find inspiration, I should say. Is there a reason that that's, I don't know, like I feel like that might be a common thread in a lot of composition.
Absolutely. Yeah. Constraints are hugely inspirational. So like I was kind of talking talking about having like the instrumentation set. And if you know the specific people, the constraints of those. So like working for a community choir is going to be totally different than working for some professional choir. So having those constraints in mind, it already starts to like generate ideas. Like what can I work with a community choir? Like maybe I'll have limited ranges for the different parts of the ensemble. Or working with like a third grade choir, the constraints of like, how do I do rhythms that they can follow along with? If they play a recorder, like what notes do they know on recorder? And it just kind of gets the whole process rolling along. Like I have these notes to work with, I have these constraints, hugely inspirational and like frees you up to think about other things. So people talk about this all the time, but like if you're looking at a blank canvas, it can be paralyzing if you're a painter or something. Just like, I have no idea what to do. Like, what do I do? So you just start with like one brushstroke and then go from there if you want, or have like the whole thing up in your mind. But even it's even different with composers. It's not a blank canvas. It's like a void of nothingness almost, that like, it's not like canvas. You don't know the material. You don't know like whatever paints you have available. You haven't defined your medium in any way aside from just like chosen sounds in time. So having any kind of constraints of instrument time length, or like if you're drawing inspiration from a specific thing, like this has to feel like whatever season's changing, like that just starts the idea train rolling, just gets things moving right along. So that is hugely helpful.
Yeah. It actually leads me to my other question. I mean, I assume there's moments when you are walking through, let's say on a hike somewhere, and suddenly you have this vivid inspirational moment. Does that happen often, or is it more of a process like you're talking about, cultivating ideas from constraints?
I think I usually go more with the process, less moments of inspiration. So I'll usually try to have like a plan of the piece all set up and then try to find moments of inspiration after that. But it usually comes just like sitting, thinking, ruminating for a while. So for instance, a set of pieces I wrote for Keown, a wind quintet in town, excellent performers. I was writing a piece for them for a performance at the Schubert Club in February 2020. So that was my last pre-pandemic performance of my music. And I was writing them a set of pieces. I'd already kind of decided to write a set of pieces based on paintings of trees. So that was like another in my set of nature pieces. But yeah, a set of pieces about paintings of trees. So once I knew that, I was kind of looking as I was like moving through, going on hikes somewhere, just like looking in my neighborhood. I mean, there's trees everywhere, just like looking at them, thinking about them. In the house I lived in at the time, there was just a really nice tree right outside, huge one that a turkey would roost in often, which was kind of fun. But while I was thinking about, I know I have to write this set of pieces about trees, I was able to take a trip up to Ely and walk around with another composer friend, Zach Baltich, and walking through some of those woods there, just the kind of like rhythm of walking and the introspection that can come with that inspired one of the movements specifically, just like moving through that forest at that time in that moment, just brought some rhythms and pitches to mind that I remembered and kept in mind and put into the piece. So that was a singular moment of inspiration, but it was kind of couched in already knowing what I'm doing, for who, when, and having the painting in mind already actually for that piece. So it's like, oh yeah, this, the feeling I'm having right now matches up with the feeling of that painting. So yeah, it's like kind of both.
Yeah. Can you describe the emotional feeling when you release your music to performers to then work on, rehearse, and then perform?
Yeah, it's been, as an early career composer, like longer, so I'm still early career, but like very beginning, it is super stressful to just like, ooh, what's going to happen? I have no idea. Like, is this performable and things like that, when I was like first putting things in front of performers. But now I feel a little more comfortable with that. Just, I know what to expect. There's not as many surprises of like not knowing the range of an instrument or something. Like, I'm more capable in a lot of those ways, and the music will turn out more like how I expect. And really, it's just invigorating to work with a live ensemble, and especially to workshop pieces. If I'm able to like have that extra time with an ensemble to say like, ooh, let's try this, or let's try that, or let's figure out how this all comes together. Just like the timbres of those players in the room, how everything fits, like let's bump that down an octave or something. Let's put this new accent on a little spot. Yeah, very exciting. I always like it when I have that opportunity.
So when you are seeing a premiere of your work, do you ever feel, and especially I guess maybe when it comes to what you've cultivated internally with your perspectives on nature and the little things that you've talked about, do you find that it illuminates something further about your initial inspiration that you didn't notice before? Or is it kind of like, yeah, okay, that's what I wrote and that's about right?
It can definitely illuminate things. And sometimes it illuminates things for other people. Like, so for the Schubert Club performance, we had the paintings in the program so people could look at the paintings and see the music I wrote about it. And one of my friends came up to me afterwards and said, like, I think I understand you better, like looking at that painting and what you took out of it. Like, I still don't quite know what she meant by that, but like it illuminated something in someone else for like how I interpreted this painting. That one in particular, speaking of melancholy stuff, that was a very melancholy piece for me. So yeah, it illuminates things in other people. But for me, some of it can be... So again, working with that piece with Jason, we're recording it.
The Alt Survivor.
Alt Survivor, yeah. So he's spent a lot of time on it and just workshopping it with him in multiple sittings, just seeing how that piece grows. That definitely gives me a new sense of like what that piece is and how it relates to the inspiration. And part of it is when performers ask for like more details. So when I'm writing music, I don't try to think too hard about like this means this and this is that, or like this inspiration is drawn specifically from this place. It's all kind of rattling around in the back of my mind. For instance, Bjorn asked for the 10th Wave piece for a little more information about like where I was coming from with Dunes, one of the Port Crescent State Park pieces. So when I wrote out the whole story, it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like I was thinking of those things and this is how like that connects to my memory of that place. And this like moment in the piece means this feeling. So some of it might be ascribing things to the piece after the fact. Again, that kind of like fitting together puzzle piece idea of like, I've done this already. How does it all match up? So like figuring out things after the fact happens a lot for me. So yeah, hearing the piece actually like illuminates a lot of those things.
Are there any final thoughts about your connectivity and relationship with nature?
Yeah, my connection with nature. It's just really, so I would like to be someone who meditates more. And I think walking around, getting lost and looking at random little things around, just like the way that leaves will wiggle on a tree I'm looking at right now outside my window, or just like the way tiny little bugs move around. Getting lost in those things becomes something like meditation for me, I think. Just like letting my thoughts go, letting my brain expand somewhere outside of myself without thinking too much, without worrying too much, without following any kind of like story. It's not like watching movies or playing video games or anything. Like it's not so engrossing. It's just kind of like things are happening out in the world, just kind of moving along. So yeah, nice to engage with in that way, in a more day-to-day life, walking around kind of way. But that's an important connection for me, going outside and looking at stuff.
Yeah, I mean, what you reminded me of was a perspective of like a 4 or 5 year old looking at the world, you know? There's like an innocence to it.
I think that's accurate. Yeah, yeah. Not trying to like learn too much or like, well, maybe there's some learning or curiosity aspect, but just kind of like looking, just kind of looking at stuff.
Pre like iPhones and stuff like that. Pre digital screens. Yeah.
Which I do appreciate having the iPhone just for like a high quality camera to capture those things and then like connect them with other things or send photos to family. It was like a big thing in the pandemic. Just like, here's what I'm looking at today. Here you go. Here's a sunset. Here's a turkey. Here's this bug I saw. Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks for sharing your insights of your compositional process and also how important nature is to that.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty easy to say that for most musicians and creatives that we draw so much inspiration from nature. I myself include myself in the mix here. I love hikes and I love going outdoors too. So
yeah, it's definitely one of the primary foundations of art.
I think so. Yeah. May I ask you 2 final questions?
Please.
What is one piece of advice you'd tell your younger self about entering and pursuing a music career?
I think a pretty universal piece of advice, and one that I have done a bit, but I wish I did more, is just writing for your friends, just writing for people around you, just saying like, hey, you want to play this piece? You want me to write you a piece? Here we go. And not waiting for like a big ensemble to work with, not waiting for anyone to ask you for anything, but just like, hey, do you want to do this little thing with me? Not worrying too much about like money or a reason to do something.
Or whatever. Yeah.
But yeah, just going and doing stuff, working with people next to you, working with your immediate circle.
My second question, as we enter, I don't know what you want to call it, a phase 4 or whatever version of the pandemic. I don't even know where we are at this point. What elements of your musical pandemic life would you want to continue and what would you want to shed?
For continuing, I really do enjoy the live remote stuff. It's like a huge extra amount of work in terms of like tech and all that, getting all that organized. But it really is like an interesting, it feels like working with something new and treading kind of new ground. People have been doing it, but it's like, it feels new and vital and useful. I mean, so like in a pandemic, it's great because you need it. You need that kind of thing. You need to be able to be in different places and put things together. But even after that, I mean, like it globalizes music in a really cool way that you can perform with people in your area or perform with people across the state, across the country, across the world. And it's no different. I mean, like you might have a slightly longer connection with someone in Germany, but you can play music with them. You don't have to take a flight to Germany and like get the venue, and audiences don't have to get the childcare to come to the performance and all those extra things. So it feels like a really cool thing, just like environmentally, in terms of like not having to travel so much to play with people. And then all those kinds of benefits, bringing the audience like right into that moment of music making on a Zoom call, like with friends, it feels very familiar to me in that way. It's just really cool. So I want to do more of that stuff, even with all the hurdles and extra work involved, I think it's cool to do. So I guess something I don't want to carry forward is the lack of deadlines and lack of performances. That's not so much for me, I guess, but I'm just ready to move into a world where performances are on the schedule again more regularly.
I mean, me too. But of course, we have to be sensitive to the health crisis happening and the pandemic and stuff.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, so figuring out more creative ways to squeeze those things in, outdoor performances when they're reasonable, or these live remote things, or figuring out new stuff.
Are there any platforms or websites for listeners to learn more about you or any upcoming projects?
Yeah, I have a website, majoranomusic.com, and that's where all my stuff is. I have a Bandcamp too and a Facebook page, but you could all get to through that website, majoranomusic.com. And yeah, feel free to contact me through that. There's a contact page, and I think my email address is on there. Just, yeah, send me an email. Upcoming projects. One outgrowth of the pandemic is doing more digital music production, so not having to work with any live performers or do those things. So like working with more virtual instruments, working in Logic with those things has been something I've been pursuing more, so that's on my list of things to do. And yeah, just writing more small pieces for friends, writing more for Jason. I think I'll be working with Harry and Richardson on a project coming up soon. Yeah, just little things here and there.
Okay. And if you enjoyed listening, be sure to smash that subscribe button wherever you're tuning into this podcast. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts while you're at it. It doesn't need to be long. Your review will help others search for the podcast because of its crazy algorithms, and you'll make Sushi's day. And it's free. Make sure to share this podcast with your friends and family as well. If you want to level up, you can always become part of the Haydn Behind the Music Stand family by donating what you will on our Patreon page at patreon.com/HaydnMusicStand. Our social media handle for Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter is @HaydnMusicStand, and we'd love to hear from you at our email, HaydnMusicStand@gmail.com. Didn't recognize a piece we discussed during the episode? No worries. Somehow we'll try to put your music on. Do you have anything on Spotify?
Not on Spotify, but floating around other places.
Okay, well, there's a Spotify playlist with all our music discussed for your convenience. The link is in the
I'll have to get it on Spotify.
The link is in the description of each episode. And in the interim, just check out your Bandcamp, because I don't know if the 10th wave...
No, I haven't put that on there. I've been slow about editing those videos and audio
files. That was totally fine.
But I'll be doing that soon. Actually, so this is...
Deadline.
The world of podcasting. It'll be out already by the time this podcast
is out. Anyway, Michael, thank you so much for joining me on the show today and taking some time to let me explore your creative process.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
And thanks for listening. Say bye, Sushi!